But we are, we're getting going on Lent. So that's where I want us to spend some time this morning, talking about what Lent is and why we would bother with any of the things that spring from it. The word itself is not especially significant linguistically. It's the Teutonic word for the season of spring. And so kind of interesting how religious that word has become. And in the Christian tradition, Lent is basically understood, I think, by most of Christendom as a season where we emphasize things like self-examination, repentance, prayer, fasting, giving, and reading and meditating on God's written word. And it's pretty much come to be associated with giving something up. And that's kind of interesting. That's kind of an interesting cultural echo, really. I think it's a bit of a commentary on the impact of Catholic and Anglo-Catholic influence. But it is, in our culture, that's the echo that seems to have endured to some degree. What are you giving up for Lent? It's interesting that there's sort of this subtext, at least in the Western world, about giving things up, that there's this focus on giving up something edible. I think the generosity of the goodies at the back was just ironic this morning, and really good, too. So, should you perchance have been the person who came this morning having given up apple squares for Lent? I'm sorry. I had yours. But it's interesting, isn't it, that the giving up something to eat, you know, chocolate, of course, is the one that always sort of rises to the top. I think that's also a bit of an echo. And it's an echo, though, of the understanding that the season of Lent is a season primarily of fasting or abstinence. Most of us, you know, or at least a lot of us, have probably given something up for Lent at various points. And I'd be curious, just a little soft survey. I'd be curious to know a little bit about what people have given up for Lent. You don't have to talk about this year if you don't want to, because then, you know, you can feel like you're being watched. Unless that wouldn't be helpful, in which case, feel free to ask for us to ask you by text every day. Anyway. What have you guys, what have people done in terms of this stepping away from something for Lent?
Chicken, cheese, and television.
The three C's.
Yeah. that was in 1 year.
Chicken, cheese, and television. That's heroic.
It was horrible.
I don't want to turn this into a contest, but can anybody top chicken, cheese, and television, you know? Anybody else?
That's a hard one to top, Jer.
Sorry. It's pretty good like that.
For me, the ongoing practice, I mentioned it here before, I don't want to bore you, but I'm going to do the same thing again, because it works, is the radio in the car. I just don't reach out and turn it on for 40 days. And wow, is that a weird feeling. It can be something just that simple. We'll talk about what makes what we choose matter. I think the idea of behind the practice of giving something up for Lent, whatever it might be, is actually a helpful one. And the idea behind giving something up for Lent is not... it's not actually rooted, I think, especially for us in a contemporary culture, it's not actually rooted in the idea of fasting as much as it's rooted in the idea of getting knocked off balance. Kind of bumped out of our rut on purpose for a while, but not for its own sake. The idea of giving something up or changing something in Lent is not that we're putting ourselves off balance just so we'll be off balance. And I think that's an important point to touch on, because to do that smacks of, at least for me, of kind of medieval asceticism. It's kind of like I've got to punish my body if I'm going to free my soul for love, you know. And there's a kind of dualism about the body-soul understanding when we come at this that way that I don't think is a very healthy thing. And so this is not about that. We're not punishing the body to free the soul in that regard. I think there are ways in which we need to discipline our bodies, and there can be huge benefit from that. So this is not, I'm not slamming that, I'm just saying this is not a one-to-one correspondence, because the idea that we have to hate our bodies if we're going to love our souls is really deeply inconsistent with, among other things, God's pronouncement in that so important first chapter of Genesis that the embodied soul is very good. We won't go back to Genesis 1 today, though, I promise. So we're not putting ourselves off balance just to be off balance. And if that's not why we're doing it, then why would we do it? Why would we engage the kind of practices that take us into a place that's unfamiliar on purpose? Maybe Lenten practices are basically like a uniquely Christian religious version of a New Year's resolution, right? A kind of a formula for failure. Sort of like I pledge to not drink coffee for 40 days, you know, to show God how much I love him and how much I appreciate his self-donating love for me. And then 2 days in, my headache is so profound that I have a cup of dark roast and my headache goes away and my worst fears are confirmed. I realize I do love coffee more than Jesus. And I'm destined, you know, to be a spiritual weakling for the rest of my life. That'd be kind of fruitless, don't you think? What does happen inside of us when we put ourselves into situations where things are not the way they were, where we choose to be off balance on purpose? This is some years ago now, but I was climbing with a friend, also named Tim, at a location called Back of the Lake, just around if you're not familiar with Lake Louise, and you were hiking down what is the right-hand shoreline from the chateau. You come past an area where there's a number of cliffs right by that trail. There's a climbing area there, just no one is back of the lake. And in the middle of that climbing area, there's a little chunk that's got a huge overhanging roof at the top of it. It stays dry when it rains, so you can still climb. And it had been rainy, and so we were climbing there. It's a lovely route. It kind of splits right up the middle of that thing to about halfway up. And it's a pretty tall road. It's about, for those of you that climb, it's a full pitch. It's the length of a full-length climbing rope to the anchors, which don't go to the top. So the rope stops in the middle of the cliff, because above that point it becomes unclimbable for anybody. And so this is the route we had decided to do, and it was my lead, so I climbed it and did a nice job of it, if I may say so. And felt fabulous and had a great time climbing it and got to the top of this thing. And at the top of it, there are permanent anchors. There's a set of chains that you can clip into to set up for lowering off. And so I kind of clipped in and I was standing up there. And it's an awesome place to be because the belay stance, the place you come to at the top of the road, is a ledge. It's about this wide. It's about 4 or 5 inches wide. And it's 6 or 7 feet long. But when you stand on it with your back to the rock, your toes hang over. You know, it's smaller than your foot. So you're 120 feet in the air, standing on this little wee ledge and looking out over Lake Louise. It's spectacular. And so having this experience, you know, all the synapses in my body are kind of firing at the same time, and it's a great kind of high. And then it was Tim's turn, and so he climbed up and cleaned the route and got to the top and clipped in. And then I had to set up, there's two ropes that we needed. I had to set up my rappel to get down. And it's a little bit of a tricky process when it's a full pitch, and so not to bore you with the technical stuff, but he clipped in and I clipped in and I was setting this whole thing up, and as part of that I needed to rearrange his anchor. And I thought I was just carrying on with what I was doing and all was well, and all of a sudden Tim said to me, "Hey, did you unclip me?" And I was like, "Well, I moved your anchor." And I looked over and he was standing beside me, completely detached from everything. Yeah, exactly. So we fixed that, you know, right away. yeah, you've been telling the story now. It's a little bit, my heart's kind of going. And set up a rappel and wrapped down. And he continued to climb with me, but he seemed a little extra vigilant after that. Yeah, he's still alive, and so am I. God is good. There were a couple of different things that happened in that story that remind me of the value of deliberately putting ourselves off balance or outside of normal. And they speak to these practices of Lent. One of the things that can happen when we deliberately put ourselves outside of our normal realm is that it can make us highly attenuated to what's going on around us. And that can be good. That can be mostly good. We can feel alive, we're paying attention, we're engaged, we're refreshed, we're challenged, all those kind of things. The potential problem out of this can come if we don't use that energy to focus on the things that matter most. And I'll kind of come back to that theme a little bit, but that's part of what happened in that climbing story for me. We don't engage in Lenten practices just for the challenge of it. We engage with them to open ourselves to the things that matter most. And that's why when we give up something or take on something for Lent, we need to follow up on the openness that's created by being off balance with a focus on the things that matter most. And for most of us, that means resisting the temptation to put our focus on the wrong or the not helpful places. And so that's kind of how those pieces connect. And it happens pretty naturally. Putting our focus in the wrong place, I mean, happens pretty naturally. It's sort of like my getting so hyper-focused on that climb was setting up the next thing that we needed to do that I forgot to keep Tim safe where he already was. It's just a pretty natural kind of, I think, distraction that can be part of being knocked out of our normal routine. And what I want us to do this morning in particular is I want us to have Jesus' own temptations, his own tests, and his response to those tests kind of be our guide in this, both being knocked off balance and then in our off-balanceness, choosing to put the focus, the engagement that that produces, on the things that matter the most. Does that kind of sequence make sense? I haven't muddied that too much? All right. The story of Jesus' temptation in the wilderness, of course, that's the framing story for Lent. That's the story that gives Lent its 40-day shape in our practice. It's the story from which we get the focus on fasting or stepping away from something from. And there's a lot more to the story than meets the eye. And I think we're gonna find our three Sundays poking around in here pretty worthwhile. Let me just read us the story. That's in most of the Gospels. I'm only going to read it in one of them. I'm going to read us Matthew's account of this experience of Jesus. Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. Every once in a while, you know. Yeah, it's self-evident. The tempter came to him and said, "If you're the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." Jesus answered, "It is written, man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God." Then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. "If you are the Son of God," he said, "throw yourself down. For it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands so that you will not strike your foot against a stone." Jesus answered him, "It is also written, do not put the Lord your God to the test." Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. "All this I will give to you," he said, "if you will bow down and worship me." Jesus said to him, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only." Then the devil left him, and angels came and attended him. We're not going to get into this part of it a whole lot. It's a very interesting story because, among other things, it's pretty obvious, both from the different gospel accounts, which don't place all the temptations in the same order, for instance, and also from some of the just physical impossibilities in the story, that we're not reading here a literal tale in all respects. There is, for instance, no mountain from which one could actually see all the kingdoms of the known world. I'm saying that mostly just to say that that doesn't change the fact that this is a paradigmatic or guiding story that speaks with authority in our lives. And that's a super important underneath understanding, because otherwise it's way too easy to dismiss way too much of our sacred text. You just go, "Well, I guess this happened between Jesus' two ears, you know. Nice dream, what's that got to do with me?" And that's a very Western way to think about a story and its power. And we need to get past that, or we're going to lose a lot of good stuff in this story. I think it's important, and one way to think about, as sort of as an extension of that, one way to think about this is it's important to understand with this story and with a lot of stories that we read in the Bible, that there's a way in which they're like a great poem or like a great song lyric. We didn't write them, and the experience of the writer is unique and it's distinct from our experience. In this case, we have the same story written by several different writers in the Gospels, and their different takes on the story are unique. But if the story is truly insightful and wise, and I would use the word true, then what happens is somehow in those places we find our own story inside of them. We find our own deep resonance inside that tale, that song, that poem, even though we all know that that's not our literal, physical, embodied experience that's being talked about. So this is important to remember when we read a story like this, because otherwise it's pretty easy to read a story like this and kind of dismiss it. Because we go, this is great, some great cosmic conflict. It's God and Satan duking it out in the desert to see who walks away, who's the last man standing. That's great. That's a great spiritual story. And you know what in the world does that have to do with finding a place to live and finding a lump in my breast? And let's keep going down the list of the things we prayed about this morning, you know? Right? It's just easy to kind of disassociate the story from our everyday life. And that's a mistake. I want to suggest that one of the things that this story is about, and it's about lots of different things, but one of the things the story is about is identity. And in particular about the identity of the self. What does it mean to be a self, and how do we understand, who do we understand ourselves to be? Self-identity, huge topic in contemporary culture. If you chase down self-identity as an idea and research it all, you realize it just opens into this massive philosophical conversation. As tempting as it might be to me personally, we are not going to engage with that conversation. But it's very intriguing. We got to leave it. Okay, we're going to go on. I'm going to take a simpler approach, and I'm going to suggest that even when we're not feeling especially philosophical, we do have a way of putting some parameters around the self, around the idea of the self, that are pretty accessible. And we're going to do a little exercise this morning to both illustrate this and also to see some of our own selves differently. So everybody should have paper this morning. I think we resupplied. So you will need a piece of paper and a way to write on it for this. Everybody got what they need? You will not in any way be required to share what you write down in this exercise. But everyone but Jeremy will be given the opportunity to do so. He already got his 15 seconds of fame today. All right, so here's it. No, you can't be here. Okay, here's the assignment. What I want you to do is at the top of the paper, I just want you to write down, I am, dot, dot, dot. It's open stem. It's a starting statement. I am. If you put it down in all caps, you have a Messiah complex. All right. I didn't know you did that. I really didn't. I pray that God will show up here when we gather. I really do. It takes me by surprise how it happens. You know? All right. So then what I want you to do is just take a few moments and without being too assessing of your response, too analytical about it, and that's easy for some of us and not so easy for others of us, I know. But what I want you to do without taking a bunch of time to evaluate your responses is just start writing down the end of that sentence about yourself. I am. Just start writing down a list of words. And for the love of God, do not put down the right religious answer because you're in church. Okay? Just do the exercise. Surprise yourself,
guys. All right.
You are terrific.
That's right. This is a self-help therapy exercise, potentially, or a really destructive self-assessment. All right, I'm sure we could keep going, because we're fascinating people to ourselves. Anybody care to read their list? I'll read mine. I'll go first if you want, but if somebody else was willing to, I think that'd be awesome. Anyone? All right, Lisa. I am trite. Is that what's on the list? Okay, listen to Lisa's list. That opens into all kinds of things that aren't trite for my part, Lisa. That's great. Anybody else? Trev.
That's not a list. I don't know.
I thought that was a simple direction. Okay.
I'm a river that runs through the land of finite possibility, though at times it seemed infinite. I'm a pilgrim on this journey of life. Sometimes my backpack feels more full than on other days.
Lovely. Thank you. Never ask a poetic soul to make a list. Anybody else?
Mine sounds like a resume.
Well, you are looking for, no, your place to live, not a job.
Yeah. Hopefully not full for. Full of ideas, creative, personal, relatable, fun, awesome, energetic, dynamic, agriculture. I don't know if I am agriculture.
I embody agriculture.
Electric.
I don't know, that sounds like a resume or like a posting on a singles site. There. I guess it could be both, eh? Okay.
It's
a versatile list, that one. Anybody else? I promise to make fun of everyone's list equally. It's an equal opportunity community.
I know.
Anybody else? People that I know are hiding behind other people. No, I would never do that. I won't make you. Last time I did this for myself, I wrote down smart, busy, important, dad, provider, hard worker, pastor, wise, forgetful, disorganized, distant, adequate / inadequate, sensitive, and uncaring. Apparently I'm studying contradictions, but at least that day. The point of the exercise, in a lot of ways, and it's worth hanging on to the list, I mean, I look back over that list from time to time, because it reminds me not so much of who I am, but of how I tend to define myself. And that's what this story about Jesus' first temptation, in a lot of ways, is about. It's about self-definition. Unless we're pretty deliberate, we mostly define ourselves the way we just did. And what Lenten practices do, and what happens in this story with Jesus, is that those core beliefs, those I am beliefs, get challenged in some good and helpful ways. And we're going to get into that. What happens in this part of the story? Just the first four verses of the story. Basically what happens is the tempter or tester comes to Jesus, and essentially he says to Jesus, whatever you think you are, I am here to suggest to you that what you need to be in order to succeed in your life mission, what you need to be is you need to be relevant. You need to turn these stones into bread. You want to be loved by the masses? You want to lead a successful movement? You want to be a savior people can really get behind? Well, then what you need to do is you need to give the people what they need, something that they want. They're hungry. You know it, and I know it, and you can turn these stones into bread, and you know it, and I know it. So why don't you do that? Why don't you demonstrate your relevance to the world? And the essence of the temptation to Jesus in this part of the story is to have him do something that is needed and that can be appreciated by the people, which is another way of saying that the temptation is to make productivity the essence of his life. It's to make what he makes the center of who he is. That's sort of the nut of the temptation in those first four verses. Now that, the temptation to define who I am by what I make, that is a familiar temptation. That's the stuff of ordinary life. And that's what's going on in this story. To define ourselves by what we do, by what we produce, by what we make happen. It's like defining ourselves by what we might put onto a business card or in our LinkedIn profile, right? I don't know if you guys have ever read Robert Fulham, probably best known for writing the essay, Everything I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, which of course has led to all kinds of send-ups. But it's a pretty interesting essay. He's written a number of books, actually, in addition to that. And in one of them, he has a short essay in which he muses about what he should put on his business card. And he ponders in that essay whether perhaps he should put minister on there, because that's part of his life and career, whether he should put writer on there, or father, or philosopher. And then as he kind of unfolds this through the essay, he comes to the point where he says, you know, I think what I should put on my business card maybe is napper. Napper. Because I spend two-thirds of my life sleeping. You know, most of us do. And napping is, I am great at napping. I should put napper on my business card. He ends up choosing to just put the word Fulham, just his last name, on it, rather than trying to summarize in some other word who he is. If we stop to think about it for a moment, there are lots of ways in which we are made to believe, prodded to believe, if we don't like the idea that someone can make us believe something, that we are what we produce. And what that tends to produce in us is a preoccupation with things like products, like visible results, tangible goods, progress, those kind of ideas. Now, the way that I've cast this to this point is suggests that being occupied with things like products, visible results, tangible goods, and progress, like that's a list of evils. That's kind of an odd list of evils, isn't it? It doesn't sound especially malevolent. And it isn't. I think it's helpful to think about a list like that not as a list of great evils or great spiritual deterrents, but rather as a list of things that are fine as long as they remain in their place. And it's really intriguing to me how Jesus responds to this test. Because what Jesus does in this story, in answer to that suggestion, that what he needs to do to matter is be relevant and demonstrate his relevance by producing something needful, what he does in response to that test is he quotes this text. He says, "One does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God." And we need to pay attention here, because Jesus doesn't condemn the making of bread in this answer. He doesn't condemn the life of being productive. And that is deeply consistent with the creative and productive work that we've been given to do by God right from the beginning of the story. That's where we spent the last number of weeks, is in the middle of that idea. But what Jesus does, rather than condemning that, is he relativizes it. And what he relativizes it to is a comparison with what the text calls the nurturing word of God. And what he does, essentially, is set our productivity, our making of things, into context by saying my relevance My ability to make something is not how I define myself or my mission in this world. I define myself, Jesus says to his tempter, by my essential connectedness to the one that made me. The text that Jesus is actually quoting from is in Deuteronomy chapter 8. And I'm going to read it for us. It's one verse, 8 verse 3, and it's very, very interesting. Uses the name Yahweh for God. It's an Old Testament text, and that's why. This is what it says. Listen close to this. Yahweh made you feel hungry and fed you with manna, which neither you nor your fathers had known, to make you understand that people do not live on bread alone, but on everything that comes from the mouth of Yahweh. Okay, hold it. Yahweh made you feel hungry? This is a problem. It's really easy to misunderstand a phrase like Yahweh made you feel hungry by imagining God as the one that causes an evil like starvation, which is sort of an ultimate hunger. And we have to keep a grip on the bigger story to not miss the point. It's, and in the context of the bigger story, we need to think about that phrase more like Yahweh made you with hunger. Yahweh gave you hungers. And what comes to my mind almost instantly when I read a text like that is Emmylou Harris's great line, "If there's no heaven, then what's this hunger for?" It's as if, almost as if Jesus needs to remind himself and he needs to remind all of us that the hungers that we have are part of the good way that God has made us. The problem is not that we have hungers or longings. The problem comes when we lose our grasp on what those hungers are for. Why we have them. They exist, Jesus reminds us, by choosing this particular quote, among other things, to turn us toward the one that made us this way. That made us to be in a dependent relationship, to be those that need to be fed. We have hungers for a reason. They don't exist so we can make up our own broken ways of trying to feed those hungers the focus of our lives, and we often do. They exist to turn us toward the one that made us with that hunger. This is one way to understand the story of addiction in our lives, by the way. What those addictions might be visible and destructive, something like substance abuse or abuse of our sexual hungers. Or they might take on sort of a more socially approved appearance, like an addiction to work, white glove addictions, so-called. But this kind of thinking, this idea that we have been given hunger by God to turn us toward God, that idea is also a window into why we wrestle so hard when our life circumstances change in a way that affects our ability to function the way we did before. This is why, you guys, it is so hard on us when we lose a job. This is why it is so hard on us when we become ill or face a struggle with our physical capacity in some way. This is why deep relational change like divorce or breaking off a significant relationship is so hard on us. This is why when our roles change, we become a parent. There's a classic in our community. Talk about a role shift, right? This is why this stuff is hard on the soul. Because we have been defining ourselves by a certain way of operating in the world. And when it's taken away, what's revealed a lot of times is the hunger behind it. But the way we were dealing with that hunger is no longer available to us. And it shreds us. We don't know what to do. I've had a couple of interesting conversations this week with people that were basically asking the question, where does this crazy hunger, this passion, and in some cases this rage, where does this come from in me? One guy I sat with this week kind of told me a bit of his story, and he keeps surprising himself by just like going on these wild binges. They feel out of character to him, but he knows, and he described them as raging, and he just said, where does this come from in me? I don't think I'm this kind of person, but I behave like this. Well, when do you behave like this? And he starts telling me the story, and I'm thinking, we just had to connect a few dots here. because there's this enormous vacuum in this person's life relationally. There's a huge loneliness. There's a huge backstory of rejection by family and rejection by religion, having just dove into an adult conversion and then being dismissed by the church because of the divorce. And where does the rage come from? The only reason we can't see this stuff is because we just don't know how to back up and look at our hungers for what they are. It comes from unrequited hunger. It comes from starving. I don't know if any of you have ever been hungry enough to steal something to eat. I chose to be at one point because I just wanted to see what would happen. I stole something because I was hungry. And then on purpose, I sat down and thought about it for a while. And I realized that my stated religious convictions didn't run as deep as that physical hunger. That's a pretty uncomfortable thing to realize about yourself. I can blow it off and say, it was just an apple. It doesn't change for a second the thing that I learned about my soul when I did that. What I learned about my soul in that moment, what I'm still learning about it, is that unless I name my hungers right, unless I face them squarely and say, God gave me this hunger to turn me to Him, not to my own devices, first of all, I'm going to keep making those kinds of mistakes. They may not be that egregious. They may not be illegal. But they're that powerful. The drives that are in us, given to us by God and understood in our sacred text as good and very good, are there to turn us toward the one on whom we can't depend as the way of defining the self. And then, out of that definition of the self, then we can be productive and have it be a gift to the world. My appetites are given to me by God to help me understand that I'm not meant to live on what I can make happen alone, but I am made to depend on God for my definition of who I am. And then from that center, I'm made to live a good, productive, co-creative life. If that were the case, how would choosing to deliberately put myself off balance for a season like Lent be helpful? When we deliberately put ourselves off balance, we open our lives to the possibility of seeing things differently. And in that possibility also exists the possibility of learning to see things about who we are, who God is, how the universe is, that we really need to know, but that we might otherwise roar right past, because facing them squarely is going to make us really, really uncomfortable. We're going to really not like some of what we see. That doesn't mean we don't need to see it. When I unclipped Tim on that climbing route, one of the things I began to learn about myself that I'm still learning is that my hyper-focus can be absolutely deadly. It's not without its strengths. It has a ferocious other side. I'm still learning that. And I'm still learning that I need to not try to be self-sufficient. I will be more the person that God made me to be, and I will live in the world in a way that is more God-honoring and that is more good when I don't try to do things all on my own, when I choose interdependence rather than I can do it myself. That's part of the lesson that I started to learn at the top of that climbing road. So I would suggest to us going into Lent, I would highly recommend finding a way to get a bit off balance for the next month. Whether that's stopping doing something that's familiar or starting to do something that's unfamiliar, but something that just knocks us out of routine a little bit. And if it's something that takes us more to a desert place, to a place of self-denial and some sort of deprivation, doing without, that can be deeply consistent with these kind of learnings. That's not a bad way to kind of probe, what should I choose? We're not doing it just to do it. We're not doing it to produce the inevitable failure of the coffee story. We're not doing it because we are required to hate our body to love our soul. We are doing it to put ourselves in a situation where we feel our hungers on purpose and allow them to point us to the nurturing and defining love and care of God. That's why we would do this. And when the center of our life is aimed toward that, and I'm not talking about living there flawlessly, because God knows, and so do most of us, if we're honest with ourselves, we can't do it. But when the center of our life is aimed that way, then our accomplishments, our efficiency, our productivity, all those kind of good co-creative things that we're made to do, then those things can become gifts to the world. Not least of all because then we're able to continue to give them even when there's no visible results from that giving. But we don't get anything back. And that's all we're going to say about that today. Peace.